Welcome, Lagos, to the Morning Crossfire Extended. On Mondays, you know, we have an extended version of the Morning Crossfire. Instead of ending at 9, we end at 9, we end at 10, actually, because at 9:30, budget half hour will be on the radio on the Morning Crossfire. This morning, we're looking at the health sector on the budget half hour from 9:30 to 10. Meantime, let's talk about something that we don't get to talk about that much. And by the way, please pardon my manners. I'm Sherif Quadri.
And I'm Kofi Bartels. Great to have you join us this morning.
Yes, and you can watch us live on Facebook and on YouTube, Nigeria Info 99.3. That's how you can be a part of our conversation. This one, we want to talk about Sandship and female lawyers. A senior advocate of Nigeria and female lawyers, what is going on in that space? I can give you figures and statistics, and I'm not sure if you'll be surprised, but if you're a female lawyer, even if you're a male lawyer, would like to get your thoughts on our show this morning. We have two female lawyers as guests that will be joining us any moment now, but I want to see if I can squeeze in one or two calls from lawyers out there, and this is targeted. This is directed at lawyers. So please, if you're not a lawyer, let's leave the telephone lines for the lawyers, especially the senior lawyers who would like to, you know, share experience as to why we don't have many females being, you know, given that sonship, that senior advocate position. I'd like to also get this figure and statistics across to you from African Women in Law. And African Women in Law are saying that since the title of Senior Advocate of Nigeria, SAN, was first conferred in 1975, only one in 23 SANs is a woman. One in 23 is a woman. They also broke it down to some scorecard. They're saying that out of the total number of 685 SANs that we have, men has 95.8%. Women, 4.2%. I don't have dada. Eh? My dada, I would have said my dada is Catherine. Because this is some statistics, except of course, if there will be variation in these statistics, either upwards or downwards, I wouldn't know, right? Of all SANs, 686, 95.8% are men. 29 women, which amounts to 4.2%. 29 out of 685. Look, a senior advocate of Nigeria is deemed to have been admitted to the inner bar as distinguished from the outer bar, consisting of junior advocate, of course. Like most areas of our lives in the world today, there is a gender imbalance among the holders of the rank senior advocate. And that is where we're headed this morning, as to know exactly what is happening with or in the legal profession on the Morning Crossfire today. I'm going to be bringing in our guests this morning as they are already here. But before I do that, before I bring in our guests on the program, let me also say at this juncture that women make up approximately 40% of all lawyers in Nigeria. Approximately 40% of all lawyers in Nigeria. The country's public sector has the highest representation of women in senior positions, with 61% of practitioners being female, followed by the corporate sector. With 55%, law firms have the second lowest number of women in senior roles, 43% behind the judiciary, that's 33%. There's a report put out by, Africa Legal. Yes, Africa Legal. They are the ones that put out this report. They're saying that only 4% of, wait for this. This is an update to the figure I gave you earlier. You know, the figure I gave you earlier detailed about 685 lawyers. Now, this one by Africa Legal said that we have 732 lawyers who have been awarded Senior Advocates of Nigeria. Only 4% are women. Let me bring in my guests very quickly on the show this morning so we can get into this conversation. I will be speaking with Mrs. Lillian Ihekem Eronimi, who is a lawyer as well. She is a human rights activist. She's a member of MBA Lagos branch here, the Human Rights Committee. Ms. Lillian, good morning to you and thank you for joining us on the show today.
Good morning.
It's good to have you here. It's good. It's beautiful to have you here. Let's also bring in Mrs. Gloria Mabelam Balasin Esquire, principal partner of Mive Legals. Mrs. Gloria, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you both here. Now, let's get into it right away. I have my colleague Kofi Bartels here as well. So the two of us will be engaging in this conversation with you. And I know that there are many lawyers, even senior advocates, listening to this show this morning. What is happening? 1 in 23 sands in this country. I'm going to start with you, Mrs. Gloria. What is possibly happening? What is going on?
Well,
Mrs. Gloria, please go on, Mrs. Gloria. Mrs. Lillian, just hold on.
Well, it's difficult to really put the issues in real facts because first of the role, the position of Senior Advocate of Nigeria is deemed to be a privilege. And once you situate it in that context, it becomes difficult to be able to really ascertain what the parameters are. So, for instance, you can have, let's say, over maybe 500, 600 lawyers applying for the same position and having the qualifications of being senior advocate of Nigeria. What then becomes the criteria for paring them down to the numbers that are required for the year? So that really is a challenge, which is quite different from other clients where you have the QCs and the KCs, as is the case now, where the objective standards, once they are met, the people are admitted into the inner bar. So these are some of the issues, but more specifically with women, I think that there is a general unspoken impression that women are not so active in litigation. And I think that that's a perception because really for those who are into litigation, they're into litigation and it has nothing to do with their gender. And so that kind of a perception and that feeling that, oh, women who are in litigation are probably doing it as a side job rather than their real calling makes it quite difficult for them to be accorded the worth that they deserve and also for them to get the full measure of what they require when they apply for the role of the senior advocate of Nigeria. So these and also the fact that you cannot really divorce the philosophy of the courts with what they have known over time. It's mostly been males in that space. So it's a male-dominated space. And when it gets to the point where everybody who has qualified has applied, and there is also then the need to pare it down, then other factors which are not really objective begin to come in. And that's perhaps where you need the numbers. So when you are a male, you already have your people in there. When you are a female, not so many. So these are some of the factors that play in, which I think are detrimental.
Indeed. Right. Very interesting, madam. Some would say that, you know, when it comes to Madam Lillian, when it comes to the legal profession, you don't recognize, you know, gender. For instance, the female judges are known as, you know, milord. They use he, you know, him and all that. I know it's a loose argument, but I'm coming from the point of a standpoint of a novice, somebody who is not an expert in these things. So what do you say to someone who is probably thinking that way?
Well, they said they don't recognize the gender. That is on the face of it. Like my colleague have just said, when you said that the the rank of senior advocate is a privilege. And you know that most women, because of family responsibilities, as soon as you are called to the bar with your colleagues, your parents put you under pressure to get married. When you get married, your husband put you under pressure, you start having children. But it didn't start now, it started long ago.
Long ago, okay.
Long ago. The women, I think it's an African thing. We doesn't stop on the door of lawyers. It's an African thing that women are always put beside. Even in the chambers, when you have your colleagues, when the female are the forefront. In some chambers, the female are the forefront. They do all the briefs. They write all the briefs. What their contemporaries can bring on to the table, they do the same. But because they are that F, female, they are put by the side. The men, it's easy for them to form partnership. You know, in the legal profession, you are not in partnership. I don't think you are going anywhere. No matter how intelligent.
How do you mean partnership? Can you explain it? Can you break that down? How do you mean partnership?
Partnership in the sense that you choose some of your colleagues, you form partnership. You like, for example, you see most of our senior lawyers, they're in partnership. Chambers like Templars, you have so many lawyers form.
They work together.
Make up their money and establish their own law firm.
So you're saying women don't do this enough with other women?
Women don't do that. No, women don't. Women don't, because they don't have the resources. Women don't. Even in in families where for example, the father owns a big chamber, when he wants if he has two lawyers, a female and a male lawyer, he will prefer the male one to take over the chambers.
But madam, I have
a gender thing.
But madam, I have a quick question for you. You know, I've been looking at while Sherry was talking, looking at the requirements to be considered for a sonship. And one of those is when you present yourself before the Legal Practitioners Privileges Committee, you need to have a list of 10 judges of superior courts before whom you or he or she, because we are talking about lawyers here, has appeared and argued high-profile cases. And it struck me, because this is something we don't think about often. It's a very important topic, you know.
Yeah.
But it struck me that, as a journalist, I hardly report or read or hear about female lawyers, you know, who you say are quite in India, you said 40%, you know, Chef. I hardly hear female lawyers handling high profile cases. I mean, let's talk about all the high profile cases we know of, you know, leading those high profile cases. Is this true? Is this the case, rather? And if so, why?
Because they will not give the brief of high profile cases to the female.
Oh.
If you go to the chambers of Femi Falano, the wife is a high profile, very brilliant.
Very true.
Very, very brilliant lawyer.
Yeah.
You go to Ebu Adeboruwa and Co. His wife is a very, 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 very brilliant lawyer. Does most of the briefs. She works at the background. Has he written her name on any matter that has gone up to Supreme Court?
Wow.
They may take the glory. They take the glory. So it's a gender thing. And except something is done, it will continue. That's why you can see most of the women, we have more female judges than the male judges, because the women, they want to go to 9 to 5 jobs so that they can close and go home very early to take care of their family. And the men, if you're working with men, a contemporary, they keep you in the law firm sometimes till 10 p.m. Sending you on.
Madam Lillian, please hold your thoughts. Madam Gloria, also please hold your thoughts as well. Let's take a quick break. Let's take a quick break. When we return, we'll delve even deeper into this conversation. Lagos, good morning to you once again. Welcome back to the Morning Crossfire. On the show today, we're discussing sonships. To all female lawyers listening to this show this morning, and to the male counterpart as well, you're welcome to join the conversation because I'll be coming to you in a moment. I've got on the show this morning Mrs. Gloria Mebiam Balasin Esquire. I also have Mrs. Lillian Ikemeironini Esquire as well, two senior female lawyers, and we've been having this conversation on sonship and the female lawyers in Nigeria. What is going on? I gave a brief stats and figure as regards the number of female lawyers that we have that are senior advocates compared to their male counterpart. And thus far, we've been having this conversation as to what could be responsible for this. So you're welcome to the show. I'm Sharif Quadri. My colleague Kofi Bartels is here. Let's start this round because we're not ending this conversation until 9:30 this morning, and we'd like to hear from lawyers out there as well. But let's start this round with Mrs. Gloria. We've said quite a number of things as to what my first question as to what was responsible or what is responsible for this. We've also looked at the issue of the criteria, one of which is arguing big cases in front of, you know, about 10 top judges in the superior courts. Well, I'd like to know something. One of the things that was mentioned, of course, is that women don't really work together as men usually do. But Mrs. Gloria, why is there anything stopping women from working together? Is there any issue with women working together on court cases?
Well, I'm not sure I heard you too clearly, but it seems that you were asking if there's anything wrong with women.
Women working together. Aspiring. Yes, I was asking whether there's anything wrong with women working together as men do on big high profile cases.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's nothing wrong with women working together to be partners. And I should add, really, that the rules allow for even sole practitioners to apply for the prestigious rank of senior advocate of Nigeria, and there are quite a number of them. I also want to be able to place on the table the debunking of the claims that women are unable to work together, because that is factually inaccurate and is not empirical in any manner at all. However, we would also have to look at the dynamics of what women deal with. Mm. Partnership requires a lot of trust, and it also requires everybody bringing something at the table. So where you have women who give birth at different times, it can change how they invest in this whole process. But I also want to speak to the fact that the rules and the guidelines for applying for SAN are structured also leaves a lot to be desired. There was the 2018 guidelines, which was updated last year, which is 2022. And the rules require that a person should be able to submit 20 high court judgments, 5 Court of Appeal judgments and 4 Supreme Court judgments within the span of the 10 years where the cases are supposed to exist. However, an interesting part to it is that for the Supreme Court cases, it makes provision under the 2022 guidelines that if you have filed a matter and it's been in the court for about 7 years, mm-hmm. and the matter has not yet been dispensed with, that it is eligible as part of that application. Mm-hmm. But in all of these, particularly in the high court cases, consent judgments, which are judgments that are entered by parties in agreement rather than waiting for the court to decide, that they don't form part of the consideration for the application of the senior advocate of Nigeria. And I feel that this is disturbing because what this, supports is that cases should stay long in court, which doesn't help justice. For most women, or at least I can speak for myself, the philosophy of practice is to take law to justice. And having to do cases for so many years is detrimental both to the clients, to the society, and even to the to justice itself. We cannot, on the one hand, advocate for our prisons to be decongested, and then also advocate for lawyers not to enter consent judgment, which is faster, which is cheaper, which also helps in managing the emotions around court cases and the fallouts that come along with it. Then also, earlier on, my colleague was speaking about how that, you know, women are not allowed. Now, let me also say that despite even the challenges of women giving birth, I know quite a sizable number of women who go in there and apply for this prestigious rank of Senior Advocate of Nigeria. And yet, because of how it's not just tied to what the guidelines say, they also fall through the process. I don't want to give my own experience because I have applied for that rank. And it wasn't really an interesting experience at all.
Essentially, Madam Gloria, essentially, that's exactly my next question. Like, don't we have women applying to be senior advocates? If we do, then why are we having only paltry 4% out of 100? That should alarm anybody.
That's really alarming indeed. And when you look at the number of females in the profession, it's really a bad figure, and it speaks badly even for the, it reflects poorly on the profession. Because if we are the people who should be advocating for rights, then it should be seen even in the way we carry out our own affairs, that the issue of fairness and the issue of credibility should speak. And I am not one to advocate for any form of concessions. I believe that people should earn their way through. But when they have applied and they have all that it takes, I believe that they should be given, and I want to speak this in, you know, in softer terms, to say that they should be given their flowers. They should earn their sweat. Because it takes a lot to even put in the application, the amount of money that is involved, the rigorous process of putting together these applications and the processes, it's tedious indeed. And when you have to do all of that and return by a whipping cross, it doesn't encourage a person at all.
Yeah, but
the other aspect also,
Gloria,
is
Gloria, sorry to interrupt you. But why weren't you given you know, the SAN title? What was the reason?
First of all, when I applied, there was a letter that was sent to the day that I was interview. The letter got to me.
I'm so sorry. Please hold your thoughts. We'll be back again.
Hey,
and Lagos, welcome back. We are back on our conversation now. It's Home Run. On our conversation on Senior Advocate of Nigeria and female lawyers in the country. Before the break, Mrs. Gloria, a very senior lawyer, was sharing her experience after applying for that prestigious honor of Senior Advocate before the break. Let's take a listen to her once again. Kofi put that question forward, and then she was about to answer when the break, you know, came in. Ms. Gloria, the mic is all yours now. Let's hear your experience when you applied for Senior Advocate of Nigeria. Please go on ahead, ma'am. Are you with us, Ms. Gloria? She's here, but I can't. I'm not sure that she's on seat yet. But if we may, let's quickly go to Mrs. Lillian. Let's hear your thought. If you've got any personal experience before, or you're aware of another experience of a colleague of yours who had applied for the Senior Advocate before, and what was the experience like? Could you unmute your mic? We can barely hear you. Aha. Oh, we still can't hear you. We still can't hear you. Oh, I am so sorry. This is Leon, we can't hear you at all. Well, let's see if we can move some things around here. Perhaps it's not from your end. Just perhaps it's not from your end. Let's see, my guys are working on it now to see if we can do that very quickly. Oh yeah, your mic is not muted, so we should be able to hear you. Can you hear me? Oh wow! Oh well, somehow I can't hear you here. I can't hear you here, but I can hear some things moving around. Perhaps that's Mrs. Gloria's mic. Miss Gloria, are you back now? Madam Lillian, we can't hear you though. Can you hear us? Miss Gloria, can you say something? Oh, we can't hear the two of them.
Some sound coming from.
Yeah, I can hear some sound. It's just that I can't hear them. Can you hear me?
Madam Gloria, can you hear us?
Oh, okay. You know what? We're going to have to restart that. We're going to have to shut it down and restart again just to save time because we must have this conversation. Now, while we wait for this, Kofi, I think we can take one or two calls from lawyers. If you're a senior lawyer, please share your thoughts on our conversation today. 4% of female lawyers being given the prestigious honor of senior advocate, as compared to their male counterparts having over 95%. 95% to 4%. What could be the issue? The female lawyers that we've got as guests on the show this morning, they've tried to share their own thoughts as to what could be responsible, you know, for this so far.
Yes, indeed. We're taking the next call. The numbers to call...
Yeah, 0700-993-993-993. That is 0700-993-993-993. You can also call 01465-7190. Madam Gloria, can you hear me now? I am not sure she can hear me. I guess something is just awkwardly going on the show today. Well, in the meantime, while we sort that out, let's go to the telephone lines and hear from lawyers. Please, if you are not a lawyer, I beg no call. We're going to leave this space for lawyers and lawyers only to share their thoughts on the show this morning. Good morning to you. Okay. I guess the person isn't a lawyer then.
I can hear you.
Chair Harris. Yes, I can hear you now. I can hear you now. Fantastic. I can hear you now. Let's,
can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now. Madam Lillian, I can hear you now.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Madam Gloria, can you hear me?
Yes, if I understand your question, you wanted to know the experience if any of my colleagues that have been able to apply.
Yes, please.
The female.
Yes please.
The experience, there has been... I have had like two friends that have applied, but they didn't get. And it's so expensive to apply.
Oh.
With all the things you need to put together, you need to get your office ready, get books ready, because the inspection is done stage by stage.
Hmm.
So at all the stages, you must be prepared. So when someone goes through all that stages and to do the application and you don't get it, sometimes it could be discouraging for people to apply.
Mm.
So that's why most women find it difficult to apply. They can't. It's not affordable.
Mm. Mm.
It's not affordable.
Right. Right.
That's why the percentage is very, very low.
It's very low.
Women cannot apply.
Right. Madam Gloria, Madam Lillian, we'll come to the way forward in a moment, because we need to move forward. We need to find a way to get more women into that prestigious position of senior advocate. But let me quickly talk to Madam Gloria now as to her personal experience when she applied. Madam Gloria, please, let's hear you.
Well, I applied in 2021, and that was for the 2022 batch. And having put everything together, because it had taken probably about 6 years to, get myself ready for that application. And a letter that was sent to me to apply for, appear for interview, didn't reach me until about 4 days after the scheduled date of the interview.
And as soon as I got it, I went to Abuja and I was told, well, my own time had passed. And I said, no, but, you know, the time starts to run. Just when I received the notice, it cannot be that it will run after, you know, the notice did not reach me.
Hmm.
And we passed through that puddle. And, you know, I really cannot say what the situation was because, you know, I didn't really see how the rules played out as it claimed it would. And I think that that's not too good. And just like my colleague said, my senior colleague said, it can really be disheartening to go through that process and then to find that you're skewed out, not because of something you have failed to do, but because of things that you cannot explain. And I would say that that doesn't really speak well for the legal profession, because we should be providing the template for other you know, professions to take after. That when you speak about what we stand for, which is justice, it should reflect in our own processes, including also even the demand for the application. Because like I said to you, the idea that cases that are not settled, cases should endure through the years and through the whole hog before it is accounted, I think in my view doesn't help the justice concern.
Yeah.
Because what we are called to do is state problems. And I feel that a lawyer should be worth his salt or her salt by the number of problems that they have solved, not by the number of problems that they compound.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really needs to be looked at, because we're social engineers. And if we say that we are a priest in the temple of justice, then it needs to reflect. The justice process is quite expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Even for us who apply for go to court, we know that it is expensive, and it is our own job to make it easier for those litigants who come to the court so that they don't return by a whipping cross, having suffered what they suffered that made them come to court, and then come to court and then they spend all of those number of years just to be chewed out. Again, the other issue is how that these laws and these guidelines are reviewed every now and again.
Okay.
I checked the 2018 guideline and it didn't say how long it was going to endure. Thankfully, the 2022 guideline says that it will last for, it can only be reviewed after 5 years. But before then, you would have the guidelines change every now and again, which would mean that if you have put your processes all together, hoping to comply with a certain guidelines, then you're caught up with another guideline. And then, you know, your whole arrangement is all scattered. You have to start all over again, which doesn't really, it's not a very good one. And particularly for the 2022 guidelines, it cuts down the number of academics who can apply. If you look at the rules, it says an academic meaning singular. And I have one of my very respected lawyer who we call teacher, Professor N.S. Ojukwu, asking the question, why don't we want the teachers, you know, to apply? And I think the teachers should apply for this prestigious rank, and that it should be open to them to also be able to contend and to get into that space. After all, what we want to reward is excellence.
Mm.
And if people have earned that excellence, why not? Why do we want to stop them from gaining the full measure of what they have earned, particularly for teachers who and professors and academics who really put in a lot of work in terms of research to see that our justice system gets better? So those are areas that I would advocate for reform.
Fantastic. I like that you've already shared your thoughts on the way forward. Madam Lillian, let's also hear from you. What are you looking at as to making these numbers a bit palatable to see? 4% is too paltry for any society to have, as an advocate, to compare to 95% for the male counterpart. How can we make these numbers, the disparity, the margin, how can we narrow it down to what is more presentable?
Well, 4% is very low. I'm not an advocate of women being given soft landing and it makes the men always feel that the women are always all soft. No. I'm advocating that there should be a level playing ground. The criteria should be looked at, the criteria should be looked at, especially even women in the academia, even the professors who have written over 20, 30 books, they apply, they don't get. I think last year, it was only like two or three professors that got from the academia. When we have those professors, we are the ones that even taught us the law. They are the ones that taught us the law. They teach you the law, and when they apply for the rank, they don't get it. All those things should be looked at. The criteria is, looking at the criteria is very, very, very important, and making it a level playing ground, not making the sonship look as if it's a cabal thing. You're not the son or the daughter.
Madam Lillian, one of the sort of benefits from what I'm seeing, because you're talking about the academics here, one may be tempted to ask, what will an academic do with an essay and title? Wouldn't it be a waste of the title? What I'm saying, and please don't get me wrong, I don't mean to offend.
Since it's a privilege, it's a privilege of people who have done so well in the legal profession, presumably.
Yes, yes. But the reason I'm asking this, Madam Lillian, if you permit me to just quickly compliment, the reason I'm asking this is that, you know, you look at the benefits of having the essay entitled, you're allowed to see that the inner by, if I'm not mistaken. The lecturers are in the classroom. I don't know if they have regular. They regularly will be going to the inner bar. I don't know what that means, so you help me understand. You're allowed to charge three times, you know. Well, I don't know how many times. Let's not go into, you know, but they charge a chunk of money. Is it three times or seven times more than regular lawyers will charge? Since these lecturers are in the classroom, they don't really always go to court. That may be wasting, you know, a privilege somebody would have used to make more money. Another one I hear is that an SCN has the privilege of getting a case determined faster in a system which takes cases take a long period of time. They're in the classroom; they're not going to court, you know. So
most of the professors, lecturers, they go to court. Most of them are in legal practice. They're allowed to practice.
Okay. How often do they go to court, you know, compared to if you're writing books, reading books, lecturing, what time?
They're allowed. There are some practicing lawyers that write books as well.
Okay. Yeah.
There are some practicing lawyers who write books.
But the frequency, the frequency is what I'm asking you about.
How frequently do they go to court?
Very, very, very. I know some lecturers in UNILAG that are in court at least three times every week.
Okay.
Most of the lawyers, when you read their briefs, you see intelligence. They're entitled. It's a privilege. Why are you preventing them from having it?
Okay, so you know what? Let's unveil, Madam Lillian. Let's unveil the masquerade in the house, because I've heard that, yes, it's a privilege, then politics as well could be involved. Is it because women are not really into politics? I mean the conventional politics now. I'm talking about politics, you know, in you know, your sector. I'm talking about conventional politics, because it's privilege. It's about connections, about who you know. It's about the favors that you've done to people. It's about the kind of cases that you've taken before. It's about people that have been your clients in the political space. Is there any connection? I mean, this is me just, you know, putting this out there. Is there any connection between politics and in the mainstream politics and sonship?
I don't think there is any connection. I just think it's the gender bias issue. Someone applied for a senior advocate for the sonship. She didn't get the letter four days before. She got the letter 4 days after. She got the letter 4 days after. And you didn't give her the opportunity to even at least see what she has. She should have been given the opportunity. There should be a body that will review in cases like that, because those cases are exceptional cases. Yes, because she's not the one that wrote the letter. She does not have power over how the letter is being dispatched. So could she have taken the blame of the administrator who sits in his office, who does not know the right thing to do? She had to bear the brunt. So in cases like that, the bar should look at it. The bar should look at it.
So it's not politics.
Advocate, they should not see the senior advocate, the sonship as that. You know, there was a time late Baba Gomez, may he so rest in peace, was campaigning against that sonship should be stopped.
Hmm.
Yeah, a lot of people are advocating that sonship should be stopped. Because what is actually the relevance if it's not to make money? Does it put anything? It does not elevate the bar. Does not add value to the bar. Does it? Doesn't add value to the profession. It's for their own personal aggrandizement. So since it's a privilege, why won't women that apply, you give them? Because only 1% apply every year. 1% out of 300 applications, maybe 2 women. Why don't you give the 2 women that apply?
But maybe if you had more women applying, you would have more women getting. Because if you look at the percentage, if 300 apply,
because we don't have more women in the litigation, so to say, most women are in the offices because of the family issues. We have more female judges. We have more female magistrates.
Mm-hmm.
We have more female in the private sector, even in the public sector, in the Ministry of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
We have more female.
Okay, so maybe that's the issue then, that the female lawyers are not at the forefront.
Yeah, that's the issue. Mostly... But what we are saying is the ones that are in litigation should be given the opportunity apply.
But the percentage you're saying.
Mrs. Ballaston,
yes.
she should have been given the opportunity since she applied. Because it takes a lot to apply.
No, but you're saying the percentage of women out there at the forefront in litigation is quite low compared to number of men there. So if 2 women apply and 98 men apply, and you look at the percentage, if 1 woman is given, that's 50%.
Based on application.
Yes. Mm. If 10 men are given, that's not even up to 10%. Is that?
It's not.
So maybe we should be looking at having more women, encouraging and creating an environment for more women to be at the forefront out there, litigating.
Well, so many women are coming up into litigation these days. So many women are coming up into litigation, but women need to be encouraged.
Hmm.
How many women are in the election petition? How many women are in the election petition? Even when the election petition is sent to a chamber where the woman works, is she part of it? The men have dominated the bar. They just tell us by men saying that, oh, there's no female or male at the bar.
Hmm.
They know. They know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They know.
All right.
They should allow the women to breathe.
To breathe. Allow the women to breathe.
The Privileges Committee should look at the criteria again.
Right.
Because every year they bring out new guidelines, they make it more difficult.
Let's
you
hear.
See somebody 10 years at the bar apply and gets. Somebody have practiced law for 25 years applies, he doesn't get.
That's disheartening. It's really disheartening.
Yeah.
Let me take, because we're out of time, let me take final words from Madam Gloria as we go this morning. What would be your final word on this conversation this morning, Madam Gloria?
So my dominating thought would be that there is need for objectivity for the process. We shouldn't have backstories about how this is done. And there is also the need to impeach stereotypes. Just thinking that because someone is female, that she may not have the ability to deliver is a stereotype that needs to be impeached. But it's also notions that are being propagated and also that needs to go away. There are women who are applying for the senior advocate position. I know that they're quite in their numbers. When I applied, there were quite a number of women. And all that we're saying is that we're not asking for anyone to lean over backwards to accommodate us.
Mm.
We're just saying that if we have put in the work, then we should be given our due because we've put in the work. And if somebody has the confidence and they have put in the work and they have complied with the rules,
yeah,
then we shouldn't have a situation where, you know, women are not given and we have the 4%. 4%. By every standard,
is
abysmal.
Right, right. Thank you so much, ladies. Thank you for joining us, Madam Gloria, Madam Lillian. Thank you, and wish you best of luck in your endeavors. Thank you for call. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you, Sheriff. Thank you.
Right, Lagos. We have to step aside now. We'll take this break. When we return, we'll be talking budget half hour. Stay here, please.
We are back.
Let's talk budget half hour of the Morning Crossfire this morning. Yanolua Bolaniwa from Budget is here. He was here last week and we had a very beautiful conversation. This week, what will be going on? This 30 minutes that's left in the Morning Crossfire is sponsored by Budget Nigeria and by Budget Foundation. And we've been talking about these issues every now and again. But today we're looking at another area of our conversation that everybody should be interested in, and that is the health sector in this country. We want to know if it's getting better or it's getting worse. That's our focus. Yanolua, good morning to you and thank you for joining.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me again this morning. How's the show been going?
Well, we're trying. We're pushing it. How was the trip down here?
Yeah, I mean, there was some sort of traffic. Yeah. I don't know what's causing that this morning, but yeah, we're able to make it down. Thank you.
Fantastic. So let's start by highlighting the COVID-19 Transparency and Accountability Project, the CTAP project. It's continued from the point of understanding and monitoring the use of funds allocated to African countries by corporate and multilateral organizations advocating for vaccine access and equity across the country, and finally move to advocate for better accountability in the health sector as a whole. This evolution explained above captures the heart of what CTAP represents in nine African countries. The nine African countries include Nigeria, Ghana, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Cameroon, Senegal, Malawi, Kenya and Zimbabwe are also there, where the CTAP project is being executed. In the last year, there have been massive campaigns across the 6-year political zones in Nigeria. These campaigns focus on vaccine access and equity and engaging with stakeholders towards democratizing accessibility to health in Nigeria. Also, there's also these high-level roundtable meetings that Budget had with heads of services, directors of medicine, MPSCDA, permanent secretaries and commissioners of health across the country. Now, with all these massive efforts being put in place, Budget also understand the need for continuous engagement to ensure that the new government in power, they are aware and they've set a holistic agenda for health, where saving one and saving all the Nigerian people becomes a priority. Yanolua, let's start this way, that we've seen the effort of CTAP as exerted in the health space, and also how much mileage it has been able to gather in the prior period of this project so far. Our topic today has CTAP's activities in the center of it, so we have to talk about CTAP, and that is COVID-19 Transparency and Accountability Project. We want Nigerians to know what you've done so far and what government officials listening right now to this program today to raise to attend to the promises that they've made. What's your take on the current state of the health sector in Nigeria? Let's begin with from the foundation.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. And thank you for also following up with what we've been doing for the past 2.5 years and since COVID started. And to be honest, it's not been an easy ride, you know, across all these countries where we work. And I mean, we have a special focus and special interest in Nigeria, you know. And going straight to your question, how is the health sector in Nigeria right now? I mean, the outlook is not nice. I mean, because we have to be very honest with ourselves, because you would agree with me that just some few days ago, another health strike was called off by the resident doctors, right?
That's right.
It means that it shows that the constant, you know, and the deliberate negligence of that sector, right? And it just shows that there needs to be more attention paid to that sector across the country. I mean, both in the primary healthcare, in the secondary healthcare, and the tertiary healthcare. So for us, what we've been doing is to see how we can galvanize, you know, actions of people to call the attention, you know, of the government officials to these things, because sometimes our privilege blinds us to realities.
Right.
Yeah. So we consciously and consistently make sure that we are always delivering these messages to the right people, because we want them to see that, you know, your constituents, who are the people we serve, need to have access to healthcare. I mean, not all of them can jump on the airplane and go treat ear infections, you know, outside the country. I mean, they need to use the primary healthcare centers around them. So we need to consciously invest in that system.
Now, from your current assessment of the Nigerian situation, do you think Nigeria's primary healthcare sector has all it takes to, let's say, provide quality, very quality primary healthcare to the people? From what you've seen around.
So from what we've seen around, I mean, it's there are some states that are doing very well in primary healthcare. I mean, Lagos being part of them.
Yeah.
But there are also some states that are not doing so well in primary healthcare. And that's why you see a lot of emergence of taking cases that are supposed to be in the primary healthcare to the tertiary institutions, and even to the secondary institutions. Most of the time becomes so overwhelming that even these tertiary institutions and secondary institutions are not able to perform their own duties and functions. So that shows you that there's a gap between the way the primary healthcare system looks and the reality that people are facing, right? I mean, in one of our engagements in Sokoto State, I'm sure you saw the news. We went there and we were having conversations with all the regions, all the states, you know, executives in that region.
Right.
And we were showing them, you know, the discussions people had with us a day previous that meeting. And I mean, they were in shock. Some of them were in shock. Some of them were like, well, we know some of this. And I mean, the governor had to, you know, go into a tricycle the third day after we left, right, to go assess, because it was on the newspapers. I mean, these places are death traps. Right, and there was a lot of favoritism, because, you know, there's also a bipartisan assessment of how they attend to people,
which is not right.
Exactly. So I mean why that's not been the major contention, the governor went there himself and saw the extent of which how bad things were. And that shows you that we might think they are not paying attention, but the truth is that conversations like this, you know, also help them to see the realities that the guys on top don't let them see.
Right. You mentioned Lagos initially. What would your assessment of primary healthcare in Lagos be?
I mean, I don't want to put it on a percentage, right? But I mean, let's look at how vaccines were given out in Lagos State, right? I mean, we had access to these primary healthcare centers, and they were able to, you know, perform these, you know, functions judiciously, right? But you know, when you look at it into some, you know, some critical levels of maybe there are some things they should be able to do, they are still lacking in some places. But when you put that, you know, in comparison with some other states, right, it's, you know, that okay, there's a level of progress in this particular space.
Right.
I mean, we need to encourage them when they are doing well as well, right?
I agree.
I mean, and also give them some knocks when they are not doing well. Yeah, so that's the idea.
I totally agree. I think Lagos is leading the pack when it comes to primary health care. Notwithstanding, I think we see Lagos would have to even double up because of the population.
Exactly.
Of the state, which means there'll be more responsibility, you know, for those primary healthcare centers.
Yeah.
But in your high level meetings and stakeholders engagement that you mentioned earlier, what were the glaring efforts missing in the health sector in Nigeria?
All right. So, I mean, the glaring efforts missing, I think it's the ability of the government to retain the best hands in this country.
Oh, yeah. That.
I mean, that's a very big challenge.
It is.
I mean, one doctor to 10,000 persons. I mean, there's no way it's gonna work. Right, we had tower meetings where we had, you know, 100 persons, 150 persons, and we were asking them, I mean, if I am to attend to all of you as per health wisely,
yeah,
I mean, do you think I'm going to be? I mean, everybody shouted with a resounding no, you know, across board, because now imagine one doctor to 10,000 persons, you know, I mean, we released the research and we said it was 1,000 to 5,000, 6,000 persons. NBA replied us and said it's one doctor to 10,000 persons.
That's NMA now.
Sorry, NMA rather, thank you.
Yeah.
Replied us that it was one person to 10,000 persons. I mean, so how do you you know, put that in a scale? A lot of people are not going to be attended to. So that's the major effort missing. The welfare of healthcare workers
Need
to be prioritized.
Right.
Every day we are losing our best talent to go out of this country. And I mean, I'm not even saying young doctors alone. I mean, people who are in the level of consultants, people who are in the level of registrars, people who are in the level of, you know, residencies, they leave even in the middle. Why? Because, you know, I mean, the welfare of these people are not being prioritized. And when you complain, you know, you hear, you know, responses like, we have enough of them. If you want to leave, you can leave, right? You hear responses like, my driver is also a medical doctor, my you know, conversations that should not be heard of, you know, in the public domain,
right?
I mean, so it shows that major lack of, because I mean, when we went into the state, we realized that a lot of states are structures, but nobody to man them. Right, there were the structures. Some of these structures were there. How about it? Not so, you know, not so perfect.
Yeah.
But some of these structures were there, and there was nobody to man them. So it shows you the gap. That, I mean, there were places we went to, and they said they don't even see a doctor in 3 weeks. That they have a person called Sister. That's the name of the head of the hospital that monitors every of the situations. So, I mean, so you see that even matrons have, you know, taken over the roles of doctors, you know, in their own ways of attending to their people. Right. So that's the major, major, major thing that needs to be paid attention to.
And that's really scary, if I must add. Now, Yanoluwa, give us a brief history of the advocacy work CTAP has done in contributing to the better state of the healthcare in Nigeria.
All right. So, I mean, we have done, I don't want to rate us by myself, but I mean, from the inception of COVID, you know, a lot of people were like, we would like to know how much Nigeria has received. We would like to know how much states are receiving, because, you know, there was a lot of philanthropies around that time.
That's right.
It was a novel virus. Nobody knew where it was going. So we needed to be prepared. I mean, that also shows you the kind of fire brigade approach that we always, you know, engage, you know, in Nigeria. But, I mean, what that also showed us was that we were able to start to monitor this fund. And from that space, we evolved into health sector accountability, right? You know, trying to now understand how these funds are being used in the health sector, right? We moved also to vaccine equity and vaccine access.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there was a lot of conversations around, you know, only the high level in the society receiving the vaccines when it all started. I mean, we saw that as well, you know, in some of our engagements, and we started to say, you know what, people in the rural areas also need access to these vaccines. I mean, it makes a lot of headlines when rich people die, you know, from the virus, but when poor people die, nobody knows. As a matter of fact, sometimes they don't even know it was COVID.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, so we needed to, you know, advocate for that, for accessibility. You know, we needed to, you know, let them understand that there was a need to also take it beyond the urban areas. I mean, and that was for us.
What was that achieved?
Yeah, it was. I mean, to a very large extent, it was. It was. I mean, and that was where we started, you know, having conversations around how to use a bike to even convey the vaccines. You know, you had mobile cold chain compartments that you could use to take, you know, the vaccines from one locality to another, right? Because the major complaint was it cannot stay outside of the cold chain, you know, compartment or fridge for more than, I think, more than 2 hours or 3 hours thereabout, right? Because becomes useless. So that was one of the major conversations. It was not like the polio vaccine that people can put in their bags and take around town and start vaccinating people. But there were also some efforts to now go into those places.
Indeed. But let's talk about this engagement that we mentioned earlier. We've been hearing about your engagement with the new government and its officials. We saw the effort in Sokoto State that you mentioned earlier, in Imo, Kano, and even Nasarawa. Now, what are the efforts that you're making now to consolidate on these results?
All right. For us, to consolidate on this result that we've gotten, we need to, get the ears of the new minister. Right, the new minister for health, the new minister for state for health, right, to convey these messages to them. Right, we've had a lot of things, a lot of complaints, we've had a lot of a lot of suggestions as well. Sometimes even the people working in these positions have great ideas, but for the fear of persecution, right, they don't know how to present some of these things. So it becomes our own responsibility, because we aren't going to be persecuted, right? So it becomes our responsibility to pass those messages in the most formal way possible, right? And one of the things we're also trying to do is to have like a countrywide conversation in Abuja, where we'd have the minister in the meeting. We'll have we've sent out invitations already, and we're expecting that to happen on the 14th of September in Abuja in Transcomputing. It's really on invitation though, but what we're trying to do with that is these high level conversations we've had across all the states in Nigeria, we need to have table it down for the minister to see, okay, these are the major areas that you need to pay attention to, hit the ground running, as it were, right, so that we can feel the impact or the change that we want to see in the health sector.
Right, indeed. And good work that the Budget Foundation is doing, really. Well, let's talk more about the primary health care. What does the PHC Summit in Abuja and on the 31st of August intend to achieve? Because I hear there's one coming up then.
Yeah.
And who are the primary stakeholders that you're expecting to be at the event?
Yeah, okay. So, right now, we looked at it and said, we don't want to just do a PHC Summit alone.
Okay.
We just wanted to make sure that we're able to encapsulate all areas of health. And that's why we now, we moved it to the Health Summit.
Okay.
Right. So, just like I mentioned earlier, right, it's now we tagged it the Health Summit, building a new health agenda for Nigeria. That's the tagline for the event. And basically, what we're trying to achieve with that is we inviting commissioners of health across the country.
I was going to ask that. Yeah. Are you going to put in states to be part of this summit?
Exactly. Mm. All commissioners of health have received invitations, as I speak to you right now. All permanent secretaries, in the Ministry of Health have received invitations, as I speak to you.
Good.
And even the minister has received invitation, as I speak to you, but the Minister for State and the coordinating minister as well. So basically, the idea for us is to, all these things that we've gathered across the country, all these messages, we call them communiques, right? These are the things people want to see. People who are in the cadre of, permanent secretaries, director of medical services, head of services, deputy directors of these tertiary institutions in this state. These are the things they want to see. And we've been able to articulate these messages and to present it to the minister, right, and also have a conversation. Let's also hear his plan for the people, because we believe that when you have a healthy nation, you have a productive nation. I was hearing news about some part of our tertiary institutions yesterday, and the news were so devastating. So these are some of the things we need to get. Some of our tertiary institutions used to be places where foreigners come and train.
Very true.
Where are those things today?
No lies.
So those are the things we want to take out of that conversation. And we have also invited all of our stakeholders, right, to also be at the event, and so that we can, it doesn't come as we're not viewing these things from our own lens alone. It's a view of the whole stakeholder community for health across the country. And we have right now, interestingly, we also have an health department at Budget who takes forward these engagements, these activities, even going back to the communities. Mm. As I speak to you, they have a particular project that is running across the country, okay, where community-based organizations are leading these conversations. Mm. So, I mean, we continuously have this engagement, and because we see that it gives us result, mm, that's why we won't stop, mm, right? Because we believe that sometimes the people living in these communities, while they have their challenges, yeah, they have their point of pain, they don't know how to communicate these things. Mm. They don't know the right channels to take these things through. So we need to be there for them and, you know, continuously, you know, show them that we have their interests at heart.
Mm, indeed. And I wish you best of luck in that summit, especially because the commissioners will be there. That, yeah, alone is, to me, I think, is remarkable for the commissioners to be there. So at least they will be able to compare what they are doing in their states, mm-hmm, you know, with other states that are, exactly, doing better or not better.
Exactly.
And that can even spur them even further to, exactly, to do a whole lot more.
Exactly.
Let's talk about, you know, something I want to tell my audience now is to ask for more transparency and accountability in the health sector, because a lot of people don't know. Mm-hmm. Anytime we bring up issues of health and all of that, that's when people remember that they were treated badly here in this hospital, or they were extorted here in this hospital, or they got a very good service in this hospital. But in case people are concerned about transparency, in case they are concerned about accountability in the health sector, how can people go about that?
I mean, so you have organizations like you know, the Savicom,
okay,
you know, who was also a watchdog for, you know, how services are being rendered in, you know, public institutions,
right?
And that also includes our, you know, our health, you know, our hospitals, primary healthcare centers, mm, and you know, secondary institutions of, you know, of the government, you know, who provides health accessibility to people, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, the major thing people also need to know is, you know, we need to continuously hold our elected officials to account, right? I mean, back to your senators, back to your legislators, you need to be able to hold them to account, and not just your president.
Mm.
You need to, you know, hold your local government chairman to account. You need to be able to hold your commissioner in your state, mm, to account.
Mm.
You know, you need to be able to hold the governor of your state to account. And why am I saying this? Because, you know, I use this example all the time, because you're representing us.
Hmm.
We all cannot rule the country. We all, right, cannot be our representatives.
Right.
We have given our trust to you, hmm, to represent us. So if you see that we lack something, I mean, you should be able to advocate for that.
Hmm.
And while doing that, you should be able to monitor these processes from end to end.
Hmm.
Because, you know, the major problem we've also had is that when you check out some of these things that has been proven to be done,
hmm,
the value of money is not there.
Mm.
You see a lot of inflated projects,
mm,
right? I mean, during COVID was really, really bad. Was really, 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 really bad, because, you know, you don't even understand, you know, how some of these procurements were done.
Yeah.
So, and you want to have due process, you know, in the system,
mm,
to ensure that these procurements are done in a way that value of money is given,
mm,
and the interest of people are at heart. And I say it all the time that, you know, the cost of corruption is so grievous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because, mm-hmm, you know, a lot of times people die because lack of oxygen.
Yeah.
People die because lack of some basic medicines in the hospitals. I mean, people die because, you know, electricity just goes off in the hospital.
Hmm.
I mean, right now, there are a lot of hospitals in Nigeria. I mean, we had a lot that cannot even afford to power on their, you know, hospitals 24 hours.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, consistently. So it shows that there's a lot of gap, you know, in ways that, you know, the management of these places are being, I mean, they're being run.
Hmm.
So we need to, you know, and when the officials, mm-hmm, who are in charge,
mm-hmm,
are aware that people are consistently out there to ask questions, they would also tighten their belt straps, because we believe that, you know, when you demand transparency and accountability from someone, I mean, when you keep shouting a single thing at all times, I mean, even if they don't want to respond,
you can't be that deaf.
You understand, mm, what I'm saying?
You can't be that deaf.
People need to understand that we ourselves, I mean, yes, there can be fatigue.
Mm.
Say it all the time, because of the, you know, effort of people, they're like, they don't even listen to us. I mean, mm, there's nothing we can do. There's nothing we can, we've been shouting from, you know, since 2000 and whatever.
Yeah.
They don't listen.
Mm.
So, I mean, but we will not, because of that, you know, keep quiet. Because it's a democracy, right?
Mm.
And we need to, you know, also embody all parts. I mean, not just the electoral part, I mean, all parts where you, citizens ask questions. Mm. And I mean, part of the work that we do is to also now show them, how do you ask these questions? Write a letter to the CMD. Mm. I went to this hospital, I went to this ward, so and so happened. Write those letters. Mm. I mean, people don't know how far these things can get. Mm. You don't have to just run. You will see.
Do you think hospitals also make it easy to give feedback? I've seen some tertiary, facilities where you have these boxes there.
Yes,
that
suggestion boxes. Yeah. Yes. To be honest with you, some of them are open, quite open. Mm. Some of the CMDs that we had meetings with had mechanisms in place that could help them get feedback from the whole hospital as well. Because to be honest with you, they can't be everywhere at the same time, right? And they've also, some of them have invested in educating their, nurses and doctors, and the patients are the first, line of, for activity and actions,
right,
in this place. So
right,
we need to let them understand that, the people are number one. Mm. And when you know that people are number one, you are able to consistently raise the standards, even of how you attend to them in this healthcare institutions. But like I said, people should not get tired.
Right.
Write those letters. Attend town hall meetings. We hold town hall meetings almost everywhere in the country. Mm. We have community champions almost everywhere in the country who take some of these complaints directly to the legislators. So if you attend those town hall meetings, you speak to us, we know what is, because we don't live everywhere as well. Mm. We know how to table these things, in front of these our elected officials.
Look, Yanu, we have to go now.
Okay.
But before we go, this conversation has truly revealed that CTAF's effort, it's quite significant in keeping the government on its toes to continue to give Nigerians what they deserve, and that's quality access to good healthcare.
Exactly.
Now, in parting, what are your closing words for the new administration of President Bola Tinubu?
My closing words would be, please focus on the welfare of doctors. So that we don't continuously lose our best hands to other countries. Mm. We spend a lot of time to train these guys. So please pay attention to their warfare. That's number one. Mm. Pay attention to the materials that they use in the hospitals. Mm. If you enter hospitals in Nigeria today, you literally have to buy everything. Mm. So and you, by the time you sit down to listen, you hear there's provisions for this. But the reality says otherwise. Mm. Right? Sometimes doctors need to go to hospitals with their own hand gloves. Mm. Right? So it's welfare. The materials that they use in the hospitals need to be provided for. And also, the way people are treated in some of these hospitals also need to be looked into, right? And also, we need to now ask ourselves, where do we want to be as towards healthcare at the end of the... There's an Abuja declaration that states that all governments must spend 30% of their budget, to health. Nigeria has consistently done 3.54%, since this the inception of this Abuja declaration.
Right.
We're also calling on the new government to look at this, provisions to health, right? To help us, push further, this particular percentage Nigeria exerts on health.
Mm. Yeah, Noloa Bolariwa, Budget Foundation, thank you so much for joining us on Budget for today.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you. Lagos, this is where we wrap up the Morning Crossfire for today. It's been great doing this with you. And of course, introducing you for the very first time to Kofi Bartels.
Yes, indeed, Sheriff. Thank you very much. People are actually swearing that you and I sound familiar. So I don't know. I'm telling you, you should check the WhatsApp message.
Yeah.
So I can't tell the difference. But we get it every time. We know how we sound.
Yes, we do.
It's all good.
All right. We'll be back tomorrow on the Morning Crossfire at 5 a.m.